You are listening to From Dreams to Deeds, Join the Journey, a new podcast project of the Covenant Foundation in association with JCast Network. Our goals in this series are to share the wisdom and stories of master educators to a wider audience. For more information about the work of the Covenant Foundation, please visit covenantfn.org. For more information about other JCast Network podcasts and blogs, please visit jcastnetwork.org. You shall be. Welcome to From Dreams to Deeds, Join the Journey. I'm your host, Daron Reske. Today I have the privilege of talking with Dr. Erica Brown, a Covenant Award recipient from 2009. Dr. Brown is the Scholar-in-Residence for the Jewish Federation of Greater Washington. She is also the author of the books In the Narrow Places, Inspired Jewish Leadership, which was a National Jewish Book Award finalist, Spiritual Boredom, and Confronting Scandal. She also co-authored The Case for Jewish Peoplehood, as well as her most recent book, Return, Daily Inspirations for the Days of Awe. Hi, Erica. Thanks for sitting with me today.
Thanks for talking to me, Daron.
This is the inaugural podcast of the series, and the idea behind this whole podcast project was to share the wisdom of master teachers about their journey, their work, and you know what they see as important in the Jewish education world. So I'm going to start this with this one question that I think is sort of core to it all, which is, how did you get into this world? What is your story? How did you find yourself in this important work?
That's a great question. And of course, as in all journeys, it was not linear. I think I knew in high school that I wanted to go into education. I do come from a long line of teachers and academics and people who valued knowledge and bridging ideas and people. I married an Englishman and went across the pond and thought I would probably be a high school teacher, and I didn't get a job. And my husband was a medical student, and I was offered a position initially working for a Melton Center program taking place at the then Jews College to coordinate adult education for a group of senior educators. And I found myself profoundly in love with adult education. And in 25 years, I haven't looked back.
That's amazing. I mean, it's a little bit even surprising to see that you came into this as you did, because your family history might have sent you on a very different journey.
Well, I did not grow up observant. I became observant through a youth movement, and I found myself making certain personal decisions of commitment at a very young age. At 12, I think I knew I wanted to embrace Shabbat observance. I wanted to learn how to pray. And that's a very, very hard thing to do when you're alone, when you don't know Hebrew, when everything feels difficult and like a mountain ahead of you. I was actually in an elite prep school for my first 2 years of high school. And they had a rule there that you could only hold on to your merit scholarship if you did not miss days for religious holidays. And by my second year, I was really committed, and I did not want to go to school on Rosh Hashanah and on Yom Kippur and on Sukkot. And I didn't. And I forfeited my merit scholarship to the school, and actually said goodbye to uniforms and mandatory ballroom dancing classes, mm-hmm. and a lot of wonderful aspects of the school as well. And I lived away from home for my last 2 years and went to the Frisch Yeshiva in Paramus in North Jersey. It was a very different sort of educational environment on so many different levels, but I fell in love and I haven't left, really. I think in many ways, certainly underlines the last book that I worked on repentance, but also has helped me understand the adult mind of transition. Because I think children have an easier time making certain kinds of choices, meaning they're still in that formative stage where they need to make decisions about relationships, about peer groups, about individuation, about their professional lives. And that can be shaped very profoundly through Judaism. But adults have commitments already that are already formed. And one of the things that sometimes obstructs a journey for adults in terms of the journey to faith is they're in a marriage where the partner does not see this as a valuable journey or opposes it. They have children and are raising children in a particular environment. They may be in an interfaith relationship. And actually, where some people might have found this as an obstacle, I find it as a really fascinating challenge. How to help adults with their own movement towards Judaism within the constraints of some lifestyle decisions they've already made. You know, Martin Buber, the philosopher, believed that character education happened when people were adults. And I think most of us think that character education happens erroneously when children are adolescents or in their most formative years. But what Buber contends is, and I'm not a psychologist, so I can't comment on, you know, the moral or psychological development, but certainly in terms of spiritual development, you know, when you're an adolescent, there's so many issues that are raging within, whether it's your hormones or whether it's peer pressure or whether it's the almost oppressive burden of forming identity, that you don't always have time to sit in the settlement of your thought and reflect on, who am I at the end of the day? I think a lot of that comes in adulthood, and we have not provided a community in which adults can really think about these issues outside of fragmentary courses here and there. You know, Malcolm Knowles believed in the 70s that in 25 years from then, which we've already passed, every community would be like an adult learning village. Because he imagined that everyone would embrace this possibility. And in many ways, if you look at the Talmud, lifelong learning was what we did. We didn't prepare. We didn't say that learning ends at childhood. We believe that you get skills in childhood so that you can do real learning when you're an adult. And that's not the course that the Jewish community has chosen right now. So we've got a lot of work to do.
What are the projects you're working on now? What are the things you're focusing on now?
Well, I just wrote a book on repentance, and I think in my last two books, I've taken on a slightly different educational goal, and I want to share it with you because in the years that I've been involved in adult education, I've noticed that the number one challenge to teaching is the BlackBerry. Never before have I met a harder management issue than the level of distraction that we have not only invited into our lives, but really embraced. And it's hard to compete with the fact that we're always getting emails, we're always connected, people always want us. And the world of adult education, where we're trying to provide a sanctuary in time and space to help people submerge in thinking and creating a learning community. You know, I'm not always kind about the cell phones that go off in class, but I do tell people ahead of time that there's some ground rules, but really as a vacation for themselves. You know, let's turn off so that we can turn on something else. And, you know, the word hineni, I've started to translate the here I am as I am fully present, meaning I am fully present in this moment and I can be here as a fully present person. I think that sense of full presence is very difficult for people today. So in terms of helping adults think about things, both in my writing and my teaching, I used to try to load up a class with ideas and then believe that adults would get in their car and process it in the hours and days that follow. Now I realized that when they leave the classroom, they're already on the phone. They're checking how many messages they got. They're in the carpool lane. They're running to the gym. If you're not going to process and integrate what they've learned into their lives in the time they're with you, you're not going to get it at all. They're not going to be able to do that integrative work. So now I've started doing life homework with people while they're in class, saying, let's move from a text to a life and think about how we can apply these things and give them homework assignments that really shift perhaps the way that they're approaching relationships or the way they're approaching God or the way they're approaching prayer, any of those subjects. And so in my last two books, I actually included life homework or what I call a kavana, of something to actually do once they've completed the piece of knowledge. The other thing I'm working on is a book that's coming out through Simon & Schuster in April called Happier Endings, Overcoming the Fear of Death. This is not a Jewish book, but certainly informed by Jewish values. And it was a book that they asked me to write. Probably wouldn't have taken on the subject myself, but have come to really profoundly relate to the stories I've heard of people who wanted to die better. They wanted to have better relationships. They sought forgiveness before they died. They wanted to write ethical wills. They wanted to leave a lack of ambiguity about what they wanted. And it was just a wonderful project. So that'll be coming out in April. I'm very excited about that.
Can you tell me a little bit more about your latest book, Return, Daily Inspirations for the Days of Awe? We decided to start this podcast right here at the cusp of the Jewish New Year of Rosh Hashanah and the Days of Awe, and selected you as our first podcast, partially because this is a piece of the work you're working on.
Yeah, and I commend you on trying to jumpstart this at a time and the season when I think people are naturally introspective. You know, it's the beginning of the school year for many of us. The weather's changing. So times of transition, which we call liminal times, which are in between times, are always a good time where rituals and spiritual practices are taken more seriously. I wrote this book following a book that I did called In the Narrow Places, where I tried to do an essay a day during the 3 weeks in the summer where we mourn the destruction of the temple. And I really loved that format of a daily essay because I felt that it was like a bite into a spiritual apple that was very contained. It wasn't particularly demanding, but it also colored and framed a day. I do a lot of daily learning, that's incremental in nature. And I felt that the capacity to provide that at this time of the year would be helpful. One of the great absences I feel is the time to really prepare for the holidays. I walk into synagogue every year, no fail, for Rosh Hashanah, and it hits me like a truck that all of a sudden the high holidays are here, the days of awe, and I am woefully underprepared. And that's why I wrote the book, because I tried to write an essay a day for the days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, the 10 days. Some people have the spiritual practice of studying Maimonides' laws of repentance, one chapter a day between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, because there are 10 days and there are 10 chapters, conveniently. And so I tried to do the same thing. I wanted to write an essay a day on different areas of life. One is self-discipline, one is gratitude, one is holiness, things that we would like to master and get better at. One is contrition, being truly sorry, and I want to talk a little bit about that. And think about those things. And at the end of each chapter, I bring three texts for study related to the theme of the day. One of them is from Maimonides. One of them is from Rabbi Abraham Isaac HaKohen Cook, first chief rabbi of Palestine, and one of them is from Moshe Chaim Luzzatto of the Musar, or ethical movement. So I have a rationalist, a mystic, and an ethicist on those themes as just a little bit of learning at the end of each essay, and then a piece of life homework. So for example, if you are in gratitude, your assignment for that day is to write a thank you note to a teacher who really made an impact on you many years ago, and, you know, locate them and write a letter to your parents. Not an email, but in the old snail mail, old-fashioned way of correspondence, to write a letter to really thank them for something they've given you. Again, these are just small things, but all of them, I think, add up to climbing a ladder of holiness during this season. And again, in incremental ways, feeling that we're really taking on ourselves a self-improvement project. And that's not by simply going to a synagogue and through osmosis absorbing, you know, absorbing the atmosphere or sitting at a family table and having a brisket. It's really saying these are days where we're given the gift of contemplation and the gift of goal setting and the gift of looking back on things that perhaps we did wrong and finding real and authentic ways to move forward.
You said you mentioned contrition, being truly sorry, and you said, "Oh, and I want to talk about that more." So tell me more.
Yeah, I actually I found an article in the Wall Street Journal a few years ago that brought some psychological research that was done through the University of Waterloo in the United Kingdom, where they identified 8 aspects of a sincere apology, and I want to share them because I think they actually touch in many ways on the core of Jewish notions of forgiveness. So here's the 8, and they're kind of a step procedure, I suppose. One is remorse. One is the acceptance of responsibility. One is the admission of wrongdoing. One is the acknowledgement of harm. One is the promise to behave better. One is the request for forgiveness. One is the offer of repair. And one is explanation. And all 8 of those things have to be present in order for a person to feel that they have the capacity to forgive another person. I think a lot of times we say to people, "I just need to hear sorry." But it actually doesn't really work. And it doesn't work because we sometimes do need an explanation. And so a lot of times in the very superficial way that we have of moving in the world at this season, where we run up to people and say, you know, do you mochel me, right? Do you forgive me? Do you forgive me? Do you forgive me? Do you forgive me? And then realizing we really haven't done anything. We haven't really come to terms with the hurt that we've caused. And so I think on both levels, what we're seeking in forgiveness and what we need to do when we ask for forgiveness, I think we need to, dig a little bit deeper. And actually, we are the basis of forgiveness that we have in the Machzor, in the prayer book, actually comes from the 9th chapter of the book of Daniel. That's where Daniel takes many of these steps. He realizes that things are going wrong in the community, and he wants to take some personal responsibility. So he expresses remorse and accepts responsibility and makes a statement of wrongdoing and acknowledges the harm and promises to behave better and requests forgiveness and tries to repair it and tries to explain it. And so I think in many ways, the research that we have today on forgiveness coheres with very ancient texts.
Growing up, my mother said that there's a tradition that if you say, you ask for forgiveness 3 times, then even if they say no, you're forgiven.
That law points to something very profound in the act of forgiveness, and that is you may be at the point where you're ready to ask for forgiveness, but you can't assume that the person you're asking is ready to forgive you. That's a process, and it takes time. There's certain kind of trajectory of acceptance, and sometimes there's a lot of water under that bridge. I'll never forget a few years ago, every year at this season, I do a lot of teaching. And a few years ago, I was teaching in a synagogue in downtown DC. And I was talking about how difficult it is to be forgiving, not to ask for forgiveness, like, you know, the Fonz always had trouble saying sorry, but the difficulty of truly granting forgiveness, because sometimes we do that superficially also. We say, "Oh, I forgive you," but really we're holding it. It's lodged very deep in our souls, the insult, the hurt, the pain, the resentment. And I spoke about the power of being a person who can forgive and how compassionate you had to be. And it was a very deep class. We talked a lot about human vulnerabilities. And a few months later, I saw a woman in a restaurant who came up to me and said, "You know, I was in that class that you gave in September on forgiveness. I need to tell you that it forced me to actually seek out my brother and accept his forgiveness. We hadn't spoken to each other in 20 years, and we're speaking to each other today." And I was so deeply moved by that, because we're not in the business of teaching to present intellectual ideas alone. I think certainly in the way that I see it, We're here to provide a platform for adults to achieve what Erickson believed was the highest level of moral development. And those three last of his eight steps happen in adulthood. Well, many of us walk through the world as big children. And the fact that she had the emotional maturity and the courage to do that was really a gift for me and a learning experience for me.
What's the next larger project you want to see? What do you see as an important issue to think of that we should be thinking about in the Jewish education world?
For me personally, I'm doing a lot of leadership development work. I do that as my day job in the Federation. I'm very intrigued by the lacuna in leadership, the fact that I think we have a bankruptcy of inspiration in leadership. I think there was a day in the Jewish community when to be a lay leader in the community was a profound sense of honor, that you felt honored to be able to lead. I think today we perceive it as more of a burden, sadly. And part of that has to do with the consumer versus stakeholder culture of Jewish organizational life. Used to be you moved into a community, you joined a synagogue, you joined the JCC, you joined the institutions that marked and contributed to milestones in the life of yourself and your family. Today, it's almost a fee-for-service organizational life where we drive in and out of institutions. I don't think we're going back. I think that the next big project for the Jewish community is to reimagine Jewish institutional life. That's a huge project because federations, JCCs, most Jewish organizations, Jewish social service agencies that are over 100 years old are looking at a very different Jewish community than they did when they started. Certainly congregational schools, Hebrew schools have a long way to go. Some people are taking stabs at trying to innovate within those institutions. And I think if you really love Judaism and Jewish life today, you have to break it a little bit in order to put it together again in a meaningful way. That's a very hard message. And it's not a message that's anti-establishment, quite the opposite. If you love the establishment, you know, if you love the fact that we have a remarkable network and safety net for all aspects of Jewish life in virtually every Jewish community in North America and beyond, you have to love it enough to say when it's not working. And that's the big project to tackle. It's not my project alone, obviously. It's our collective project. Just as we've been talking about tshuva, a repentance for individuals, I think there's repentance for organizations on two levels. One is that organizations need to know when they need to change and need to apologize for not creating a better customer service. And I think we also need to forgive organizations when we have a bad experience through them and not pigeonhole them and say, this is the way that you're always going to be. We tend not to think of that. And that collective aspect, which was certainly present in the ancient days of tshuva, where the high priest would make a sacrifice for our collective sins. So we've got the collective sin of Jewish institutional life, where it's hard to lead today. It's very hard. And so we've got a lot of work to do.
And we appreciate all the work that you are doing to help us move forward in this. If people wanted to learn more about your work, where would you send them on the internet?
Well, I have a website called leadingwithmeaning.com, and I do a weekly Torah essay called Weekly Jewish Wisdom. It comes out on Thursday, and you can subscribe on that on my website.
Erica, thank you so much for sitting with me today to talk. This has been really amazing, and I really appreciate you taking the time.
It was my great pleasure. Wishing you, Daron, a wonderful, meaningful, blessed year ahead.
We hope that you've enjoyed this episode. Our next conversation will come out in 3 weeks on October 3rd and will feature master educator Rivi Pupko-Kotenik. But please join us next week for a short teaching by Dr. Erica Brown on repentance. The opening and closing music of this episode was Lichi Lach by Debbie Friedman, recorded live at the Covenant Award Dinner in 1996.